Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Quinn Kesnick. And once again, Quinn, we started the season in the closet podcast studio, and we're going to end it in the podcast, the closet podcast studio.
There's a lot of history on these walls. You have every back issue of Inside Lacrosse magazine. I mean, I could spend a week in here reading through some of these old articles, some of these features, and looking back at some classic games. We also have a special guest for the first time, my daughter, who is reading Harry Potter quietly on the floor.
Yes, it is certainly an enjoyable way to begin summer vacation, reading Harry Potter on the floor in the podcast studio. But we are going to dive in. You talk about all the history that's on the walls. I want to talk about the present and future that is in your ears right now. You know, so we might, you and I, connect a few more times over the course of the summer, but for all intents and purposes, we're going to consider this to be the closing chapter of the 2017 season. And I want to start off by giving a special thanks to all of our podcast listeners. You know, Inside Lacrosse has been producing podcasts since 2009, and we really invested and reinvested in 2017. We joined forces with Audio Boom, who's been a great partner, distribution platform, as well as working to get us some advertising. And as a result, since February 6th, when we launched on them, more than 400,000 downloads and listens of our podcast. Super excited about the engagement that we've gotten, and really proud of the Inside Lacrosse staff for the way that they diligently put together the plans, brought on a lot of guests, and shared a lot of information over the course of the season. So that being said, as we bridge from in-season to off-season, we're not done. We've got what I think is going to be a pretty interesting schedule from here through the end of August. So on Monday, I'll be doing a weekly interview show. So I'll bring in a guest and talk at length with him. Last week was the first, and we talked with Taz, a former professional wrestler turned wrestling commentator, radio personality, whose son, Tyler Sinertra, is a graduating senior from Plain Edge High School on Long Island, heading to Bucknell, a long stick middie of the highest variety. And it was a great conversation. Really interesting to get the perspective of a lacrosse dad who didn't grow up with the game, but as so many do, wishes he had grown up in Brooklyn. I thought that was an interesting conversation. And looking ahead, a lot more folks that we're going to talk to that span the spectrum of investment in the sport. On Wednesdays, you can catch up with Kyle Devitt and Chris Rosenthal as they talk about Major League Lacrosse. And on Fridays, we're going to bring together the collective brain trust that talk about the recruiting landscape. So that includes, I'll be making some appearances, Josh Davey, Jeff Shannon, Dan Abern, and a whole lot more as we continue to navigate this summer recruiting landscape. Last thing I want to mention and thank is our supporters. Certainly our chief sponsor, Sideline Swap, really interesting product. Got an opportunity to meet those guys in Foxborough at the NCAA Championships and really excited about what they're trying to become. They look like the Play It Again Sports Online. Paul Rabel Experience, who we brought on in the middle of May. And then, of course, Blue Apron and the forthcoming ZipRecruiter, who were facilitated by our friends at Audio Boom. So shout out to all of our partners. And while we're at it, why don't we talk about Sideline Swap? It's where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear, find deals up to 70% off on heads, shafts, helmets, and more, or snag unique gear from college and the pros. Sideline Swap also lets you sell old gear simply and securely. List in seconds, and they'll send you a prepaid shipping label when it sells. Visit sidelineswap.com today to get started. Yo, I saw some Notre Dame Cascade S's on there going for a grand last week.
Yeah, I still want the Kevin Corrigan lime green warm-up outfit from early May or late April that he sported in that one game where Notre Dame came out with the white unis with the green trim. That's a great jacket. You know, had they made championship weekend and the national final, Kark was going to run the stadium stairs while Corrigan coached on Sunday in a leprechaun outfit. That was a wager that existed. Unfortunately, Notre Dame made an early loss in the tournament.
Well, so as a thank you to our listeners, we are going to be taking your questions and answering them. That's how we're going to spend this
yeah.
podcast.
No, I think you know, as we look forward over the course of the summer, Terry, for us, I think there are going to be moments this summer, newsworthy items where we will want to get together and do a podcast, whether it's a coaching hire, whether it's a big event like the Warrior World Series of Youth Lacrosse or the Under Armour, and talk about, you know, afterwards, talk about some what stood out and things like that. And then obviously the Committed Academy and some of those higher
profile?
Yeah, profile showcases. So, but for this is kind of a wrap-up. In my eyes, this is a wrap-up of 2017 and a looking forward.
So let us begin at what was a conversation that I was surprised at how much it gained momentum at the end of the year. And oftentimes these are so important because they determine the forthcoming rule cycle. This is a rule change summer, so we're going to turn our attention to this in August when the representatives of the lacrosse community meet in Indianapolis to talk to the NCAA about changing rules. Dom Starja weighed in a couple weeks ago as the good of the game director for the MLCA and shared his thoughts. But we're going to start with the face-off. 24/7 Lax asked us, what do we think of the idea of a face-off lineup card like in baseball or PKs in soccer? We also had a Twitter handle who I'm not totally comfortable saying on the podcast. He asked, how about this? All the players on the field for the goal have to be on the field for the subsequent face-off. It's like icing in hockey. The team that gets scored on will presumably still have an extra pull, and the D-mids are better at ground balls. Allowing one team subs is too preferential. And then the last point that I wanted to bring to this conversation wasn't a question directed toward us, but last night during the Cavaliers Golden State Warriors game 3 of the NBA Finals, Ryan Boyle tweeted that he was watching the pace of play and just couldn't help but imagine what lacrosse pace would be like without faceoffs after a goal. Just making the comment, can you imagine what basketball would be like if after every basket
they used to do that?
They reset it.
How it was played.
Exactly.
And so the team with the 8-foot player would win every tip and hold the ball forever. And so basketball has evolved gradually to where there's a shot clock and a three-point arc. My biggest question is it's not face-off related. We've cleaned up the face-offs enough. I think maybe spreading the sticks wider, maybe by another inch, can't hurt things. But going forward, we need a 60-second shot clock. We talked about this last week. I'm very much in favor of that. And then you've got to figure out the unintended consequences. Is everyone playing a zone? Do you need to have a two-point shot? I just think that's where we need to be. Everybody that I've talked to who watched the national championship and or the semifinals this year said, yeah, I was watching those games. They had high hopes, and they were disappointed by the quality of the product on the field. I would like one of your interns this summer to sit down and time the national championship game between Ohio State and Maryland, noting the stalling of the shot clock, how many there were. I think Maryland unofficially had 9. But how much dead time was in that game for subs and then for worthless moving around? Okay, if each possession, and let's say it was a 25-possession game, it was a low-possession game, if each possession, I mean, you're looking at 25 absolute minutes of that game that the players were not playing lacrosse. And we got to do better. We got to do better. I said it in our last podcast, I felt like we left our best effort not on the table, and when we're on, you know, the big network for a championship game, we didn't deliver a pace and a tempo that was suitable for mainstream America.
And that's on top of a 2016 championship weekend, which was great in terms of
correct.
Pace. And that's
correct.
Where I think one of the narratives coming away from this championship weekend is, was all of that progress or perceived progress undone?
Well, when you have a team like North Carolina and Brown in championship weekend, they're playing a little more freestyle and an upbeat style. Those teams did not have great success this year. The Rutgers of the world, the Browns of the world. That's just the way the cookie crumbles, Virginia. Unfortunately, all the defensive-based, slow-tempo teams did well this year.
And that does incorporate the issue of the face-off. The more possessions per game, the less importance of each individual face-off win. Now, that being said, if there is a dominant face-off guy, a high-possession game, he can be even more important. What I don't understand about people calling for changes to the face-off is, do they think that the actual mechanism is not germane to the sport and that's why they want to see it out? Or do they think that a face-off guy who is a specialist has too big of an impact on the outcome?
Well, I think they point to Trevor Baptiste as an example of a face-off man who has too much impact. One player in their eyes, I guess, shouldn't determine or dictate the amount of possessions, a huge disparity that he can create. One note aside, you know, today in my gym, there's a giant poster up on the wall that's 10 years old this year, and it's of a certain face-off specials, and it just hit me today. It's a semifinal game, among probably a Hall of Fame faceoff specialist, who took his team to new heights, who in the semifinal game struggled and did not play one of the better games of his career. And it just hit me today that that paralleled Baptiste's year. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I don't.
Alex Smith, 2009.
2007.
Check that. 2007. 10
when
years,
when
yes.
And when Pizer
against
went
Pizer.
Early.
There's a poster of Pizer scooping up a ground ball and Smith laying prone on the ground diving for it and didn't get there. You can't see the athletes, but you see 12 on the Hopkins glove, and I can see I know Alex, and so you see his face. And I look at that every day in my gym. It's used as a marketing tool. You know, it's something like perseverance or whatever, and it just reminds me of a face-off guy with all the high hopes in the world. You know, he blamed the noise. Pizer beat him to the whistle that day for whatever reason. Alex will be a Hall of Famer, I believe. And that repeated itself. And today, unfortunately, like 3 weeks after the event, I'm saying, oh, yeah, everybody was assuming that Baptiste would get to 85%. Well, maybe we shouldn't have followed suit so willingly.
And I think that Hopkins' final was like 9-5 or something like that. It was a game with relatively few faceoffs, which compounded the fact that Pizer was
very
was,
low scoring. Game was over on at halftime, though, and Hopkins really, again, we're talking about ancient history here. 10 years ago, Hopkins took fresh legs into the finals, whereas Duke was taken into the 15th round with haymakers, and they weren't the same. They didn't practice on Sunday, and I really thought that cost them on Monday in that championship game. In my eyes, Duke had the better team by far.
That was also the game where I really thought Paul Rabil took a next step in his career because he finished that game with 5 assists, and prior to that, I think he was kind of viewed mostly as a goal scorer, and that was the point at which he became more of a dual threat midfielder from an offensive perspective.
But we digress on a tangent.
We are very good at digressing, particularly this time of year. I mean, if there aren't any other thoughts on the face-off, let's move to another conversation that I was almost as surprised developed at the end of the season, and that was about the dive. I mean, this is a conversation that at points during my tenure at Inside Lacrosse has been raging, but has really laid dormant for the last 5 years at least. Certainly the dive exists in a different form in the MLL, and it's worth pointing out something that Matt Kinnear is working on. One of the common refrains you hear when people talk about the dive is it was taken out to preserve the safety of the goaltender.
Yeah.
To which a common response is, I've never heard of a goalie getting injured. There's one very high, I wouldn't say high profile, and that's why it's an interesting story because not a lot of people know about it. But Alex Krawick, who is a Division II goalie, I believe, I think he played at Lemoyne, but I could be wrong on that, in an MLL training camp had his leg broken by a dive, and is still 2 or 3 years later struggling with the injury sustained in that I believe a compound fracture of his tibia.
Wow.
And you know, so the point is, yes, it is rare that goalies get injured because of the dive, but it is not impossible. So it's at least a worthy consideration. But I am of the opinion that goalie safety was not or is not the primary reason not to bring it back.
Yeah, you know, I always had an issue with the dive in that if there's contact between the goalie and the ball carrier in the cylinder, the goal should be disallowed by rule. The other thing is we can use two circles to protect goalies if that's the case. And you watch the Major League Lacrosse. I can't name a Major League Lacrosse goalie in a game recently who's been injured on a dive. And I think it favors aggressive goalies, believe it or not. I mean, I always felt that it was my job to cut the corner and to beat that diver at goal line extended and to protect my defense. And if my defender was playing a strong top hand position, then I would come underneath him and shut the door on the diver. And you know, I just thought it was a fun play. It's been a highlight filled play, but as you said, you know, it had disappeared only to resurface because at the pinnacle moment of a national semifinal, a national semifinal game, we saw two dive shots, and so all of a sudden it push the button again, and we're back.
No doubt.
Yeah, I love the dive. I think there's a place for it. I think the referees have to talk about it a little more though if it comes back. Because if a guy takes out the goalie's legs, I believe he should be penalized.
That is the part. Your previous point was the part of the conversation that I think intersects with this idea of the shot clock, and it is that one of the things to keep in mind when you talk about new or adjusted rules is how do you make the job of refereeing easier? How do you make it easier for a fan to understand what the rules
fewer
are?
Fewer clocks, fewer rules.
And so The problem is that the current iteration of the push crease call is very difficult to adjudicate. It's not, you know, there are aspects of basketball rules that are even more difficult and more subjective and more difficult for a fan to understand in terms of like hand checks and some of the other stuff that goes on with respect to shooting fouls. But I thought that, you know, you can see really acrobatic plays around the crease where the offensive player does not fall into the crease. And so to me, you can argue that, well, the dive still has a presence. It's just you can't land in the crease if
you
take off.
You can't launch or land in the crease.
Right. So maybe the emphasis should partially be on offensive players learning how to do that better, how to take off adjacent
tangential to the
crease and landing outside of it. I think that's a weapon that is underutilized.
Well, they try, but I mean the angle changes dramatically. If you know, you think about if you're driving up right-handed and you're angling towards the tangent, or now like Doug Knight's era, you can angle towards the near pipe. I mean, so you open up a huge window there, defend, and you make the defender's job very, very difficult. You know, college defenders are fortunate that the dive is illegal because it creates all sorts of dodging angles and capabilities.
But it also creates the issue where once you get beat underside at GLE and the offensive player is between you and the goal and you're on his back, you have so few options for what you can do. I mean, you're beaten at that point, so it's not to say that you deserve a ton of options.
If the offensive player, then I beat you to the inside, I'm making a beeline towards goal line extended. The goalie is passive and doesn't come out. You're riding my back. Now I dive.
I'm going to get a push call.
What is it?
That's the point. And I think that is making that easier to understand.
You bury me as I land on the ground and you cross-check the back of my neck and my face goes in the turf and the goalie piles on. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's going to go on.
The most important aspect of that is making sure that the ball doesn't go in. Because if you get called, I mean, but it really doesn't even matter that much because it's
goal
never going to be.
Crease violation? Was it a push? Is it unnecessary roughness? Is it from hitting late from behind? You know,
I feel like the unnecessary roughness call is very rare in that situation. And so really it's just a goal, no goal, 30-second releasable penalty, goal waved
on
off.
Who?
Right. Well, it's always going to be.
You dove. But you rode me on my back.
Right.
I was going to dive anyway. So I can't call you for a push, but you maybe it's from the rear with possession.
So the fact that I am confused right now is my biggest
source of interest
in how this is going to get addressed, if not even resolved.
Yeah. And I mentioned last week, expect a rule change in terms of the box, the substitution box width coming back to the old, I believe it was 10 yards. They added too much length on that, and it's really hurt transition in terms of 6-on-5, 5-on-4s. You know, you can sub off an attackman and you pick up 20 yards defensively. Why do we need that? It's so wide. That's ridiculous.
Well, I want to thank MP Henry for that dive conversation. He didn't even ask a question. He just said, I think the topic of diving in the crease would be a great conversation.
Hey, you like to dive? Watch Major League Lacrosse. You'll see plenty of them. It's a good product.
Well, kind of the last question in this realm about rules comes from Y Crabber. He's anti-shot clock, so we don't need to talk about that specifically. Any other rules to speed up play, substitutions, e.g. on-field player faces off after a goal, lower time to clear?
I mean, on the opening face-off or on every face-off. You know, just shut the substitution box down until there's a change of possession.
Don't let
guys run out of the game. And that way you face off with offensive or defensive middies and they stay and they play until there's a whistle and a change of possession.
One of the things that surprised me most about the 2012 rule changes, I didn't think that the elimination of the horn was going to matter very much. And I do think it has. I think it's been substantial in terms of increasing the pace of play. Not as substantial as the quick restart rule. I think that's more important. But I was surprised by it. If you want to get rid of specialization in lacrosse, the best way to do it is to eliminate on the fly substitutions. It eliminates cycling the ball.
And coaches are always going to be against that, Terry, because they'll say, "Well, I can't play as many guys then. You know, I have all these roles for all my role players and my specialists."
Would you be in favor of it?
I would not. No, I just think
you'd rather just go with a shot clock.
I just think we need a shot clock. Yeah, there's a couple other tweak rules. You know, flag down situation now seems to be a green light for just stalling.
Yeah.
Like a flag down. Oh, okay, pull it out, throw it around for 2 minutes. You know, like, whoa, you know, that doesn't seem like it's doing the game any good.
The last point or comment in that respect is you know, another argument for the shot clock, which is the idea of, so you talk about flag down. There's just we've had the ball for somewhere between 60 and 90 seconds. It's not even, the shot clock's not on, not even the possession shot phenomenon. But then, like, the call timeout, come back from timeout. We saw it where.
No, I know. And there's a loose ball scramble. 45 seconds.
It's
a loose ball scramble that then the offense got a mental reset from the officials.
Exactly.
Like, they benefited from being sloppy and throwing the ball on the ground. And meanwhile, the defense has earned almost a 2-minute possession and to no benefit. I think it's simple. 60-second shot clock on possession.
Let's veer into your area of expertise. Television.
Yeah.
Suburban MLAX. Has ESPN and the NCAA ever discussed using neon balls like tennis? The USTA spent millions of dollars trying to figure out the color of the ball that's best for TV.
Yeah, you know, we were lucky on Sunday with the clouds, how that creates flat lighting and no shadows, and the ball was pretty easy to see. Excuse me, on Monday, the championship game. But no, I agree with you. You know, Major League Lacrosse and tennis has spent millions of dollars. Major League Lacrosse has not. They're still using an orange ball from year one that they've tried to rework and brighten the neon. There's better neon out there, let me tell you. And I do believe that lacrosse should be using some kind of ball with a hue or a color on it, because you got a white stick strung with white mesh, and the casual fan at home cannot follow the ball. You know, Jake Steinfeld talked about, believe it or not, glow ball technology. Okay, getting a ball for night games that actually glows, and or glow stick technology. So when a player catches a pass, his head of his stick lights up.
That's insane.
Yes, but that's what an issue. He felt it was such a big issue at the beginning of Major League Lacrosse that he wanted to investigate if those technologies would be feasible. And he felt that it would dramatically improve the viewing experience from the neophyte fan who's watching at home for the first time.
I can't decide how big of an issue this is because, for example, the glow puck where they put a microchip in the puck and then put a blue circle around it, basically, when the NHL was on Fox years ago, was a failure, and it has all but been abandoned, or it has been abandoned for hockey on TV. I don't know if hockey on TV is what lacrosse should aspire to, but when I watch hockey games, I don't see the puck the majority of the time. I base
really?
Where my eye is on how the players are behaving in the vicinity of the puck.
Yeah,
I mean, oftentimes it's because they're being blocked by the near side board because it's between, you know, it's on the ice. It's invisible to the camera position because it's on the near side board. But I still enjoy watching it because I can contextually figure out where the ball is.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the same thing. You know, hockey, it's a black puck on a lot of guys have the black tape on their sticks, and although the ice is white, which helps. But no, yeah, I think it is a valid point. I think we can do better than a white ball, and especially when there's snow involved. I still can't get over the amount of snow games in February where the mountains are on the side of the field and the coaches continue to change the color of the ball. I just, if I was a goaltender, I'd be boycotting. I would boycott for safety and say, I will not go in the net today, and I will sue the school and the NCAA or whoever's in charge of this event because I cannot see the white ball against the white backdrop. And if you don't like it, fine, but I'm not putting my cranium on the line and the gray tissue that's between my ears, however little of it there may be.
Staying in the realm of kind of wide-scale infrastructure, moving to the Final Four, HIES Lax wants to know, why isn't M&T Bank rotating back into the host site for championship weekend? Downtown Baltimore is the best host location. So for those of you that don't know.
The process. Tell them the process.
So the 2018 championship was awarded a couple years ago in conjunction with the 2017 championship. It'll be back at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. New England Patriots will host for one more season, and then earlier this year, I believe in late April, the NCAA announced the host sites for the subsequent 4 years. So we know where the NCAA championship is going to be for the next 5 years. So for the first 2 years of that award, which is 2019 and 2020, it'll be at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia, back to where we were. And then in 2021 and 2022, it'll be at Rentschler Field in Hartford, Connecticut. Beautiful Hartford, Connecticut. The first non-professional venue since 2002. and it is where the UConn Huskies play college football. That's probably where it's.
Well, how is this done, Terry? I think that's the key here. How's the process work?
Well, so I think it's difficult to know the intimate details of the process on a kind of continuous basis. That being said, a couple of the key factors. So first is the NCAA sends out an RFP for all of their championships, and that means that if you're a prospective host, you can submit a bid. And so, for example, over the course of the not too distant past, we've heard of Final Four bids from Soldier Field in Chicago, or Sports Authority Field in Denver, or the Horseshoe, Ohio Stadium in Columbus, Ohio. I believe Charlotte, North Carolina has been in on a host bid in the not too distant past. So that's the first step, right? You got to express interest, and we'll come back to the Baltimore Ravens and M&T Bank Stadium as it relates to that issue specifically. The second is those bids are reviewed by the championship committee. The championship committee is the same group that selects the NCAA tournament field and seedings. It is a 5-person committee, the outgoing chairman of which was Gene Doris, the retiring athletic director at Fairfield. Coincidentally or not coincidentally, Fairfield is the host for the 2021 and 2022 championships. Like I said, he will not be there. He doesn't necessarily benefit from it.
He's got two first names, too. That's very lacrosse-like.
Gene Doris?
Yeah.
I mean, one of them is a woman's first name.
Yeah. It's a rarity, though.
Yeah.
Usually it's male-male or female-female.
The other two names, that lacrosse fans will know that are on the committee are Joe Amplo, Marquette head coach, and Richie Mead, Furman head coach. So, you know, those three, in addition to two athletic administrators, were a part of making recommendations to the NCAA, who ultimately has the final say in where the host sites go. The award of the 4 years came as a surprise to me. It was in conjunction with all of their sports that have these types of rotating host situations. And I was surprised primarily because I allowed myself to be surprised because I was hopeful that this was going to be a sequence in which they were going to consider reviewing the Final Four format in general. I've said on this podcast and other places that I'm in favor of moving off of Memorial Day, separating the championship and semifinals by a week.
Why would the NCAA stop this Memorial Day phenomenon when someone like the Patriots is willing to put up a big check and make them happy?
That's a huge part of the process that's important to know. There had been this track record of guaranteed spend. So basically, it's a transactional process. It's more than just cash, but you're essentially purchasing the rights to host this, and then you keep whatever profit you make on top of what you had guaranteed to the Final Four now, or to the NCAA. There are aspects of the relationship that you need to meet. For example, one of the reasons that MetLife in East Rutherford, where the Giants and Jets play, has not hosted, among a litany of reasons, but one of the reasons is because of the founding partnerships with their sponsors. So if you've ever been to MetLife Stadium, first of all, it's called MetLife, so there you go. There's one sponsor. But in addition to that, their gates are named after Verizon and Pepsi. Though just right there, you can identify, I believe the third one is, one's MetLife and one is Bud Light. Well, so the NCAA doesn't allow alcohol sponsors, and then they have sponsorship deals with AT&T and Coca-Cola. So MetLife Stadium, whose founding partners have non-negotiable in-bowl visibility rights, signage rights, are in direct conflict with the NCAA. So as a result, really binds MetLife's hands in terms of their ability to bid. As it relates to M&T Bank, the issue stems, in my opinion, from the conflict that the Ravens and Orioles had over parking.
I was going to ask you about Angelos, yeah.
Yeah, over parking for, I believe it was the 2014 Final Four. This was on the heels of the year prior, a conflict between the Ravens and Orioles and the Ravens' ability to host the first game of the NFL season, which is traditionally in the home of the Super Bowl winner. And as a result, the Ravens played that game at Denver on the road, which was something that was a function of a dispute over parking and the ability to play games at the same time with the Orioles. I think that's one aspect of it. I think that another small aspect of it was reflected in the idea that they wanted to play on grass. And so, the Ravens changed out their artificial surface in favor of a grass surface, which is not a deal breaker. Obviously, the Link has a grass field.
No,
they've hosted.
I think we should play the championship game in the semis on grass. I'm a huge fan of that.
And then I think the most important factor is just the event in and of itself. did not provide the return that the Ravens were used to, that they had established over the course of their tenure hosting it from 2003 to 2014.
Right. And so the only thing that would change their opinion would be gigantic crowds over the next couple of years.
Exactly. And I think that is where, you know, the future of the event is really kind of significant, important, and we'll see how it shakes out. And, you know, obviously we're committed to this structure for 5 years. And so it's incumbent on lacrosse fans to show out if you want a better situation.
Yeah. New York metropolitan area to me is where we need to go. The other would be Washington, D.C. I would be interested to see how a championship weekend in Washington would do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that anybody who's ever been to FedEx Field would kind of blanch at that idea. That said, certainly the market would be able to support it, and it'd be an interesting and great destination for a lot of out-of-town fans who would be able to come together for a Memorial Day weekend in Washington, D.C. You know, I just want to restate one more time what I think the proper structure is. You know, I have three main points. The first is I want the season to start uniformly across all Division I programs, and later I want more high-profile games in better weather. And I think that the NCAA tournament would benefit from a change in format. So, you know, I want to see the first games being, I want a universal start date for practice of February 1, roughly, or if not that, then the first Tuesday after Martin Luther King Day, which corresponds when a lot of teams start now. It's kind of a middle ground between the very early starters that are, you know, January 2nd, 3rd, and then the Ivy League, which start on February 1. I think the first day of games should be the third Thursday in February. And I think that that would predominantly see league play start a little bit later. And then I think that the actual championship and semifinals should be played later. So I propose that the championship game be the second Thursday in June, the semifinals be played the first Saturday in June, so 5 days before the championship, and that the first round and quarterfinals be played over 4 days in Memorial Day weekend. So basically, if you play your quarterfinals, if you play your first round games on Friday, you play your quarterfinal on Sunday, and then Saturday, Monday for the other group. I would love to see a host of that semifinal round like Navy or Army, and then say if you were to play the semifinals at Army on Saturday, you would play the championship at Talon Energy in Philadelphia, 20,000 seat stadium, the subsequent Thursday. I think it would be a great format.
Interesting. Just had this fun idea of bringing all 16 teams to one venue during a Memorial Day weekend. You have two first-round games on Friday night, two first-round games on Saturday afternoon, two first-round games on Sunday, two first-round games on Monday, all from the same field.
That'd be awesome.
You would like that idea?
Well, I think that there's value in keeping the tournament 3 weeks so it doesn't go too late into June. And so that's where, you know, the idea, you could do this with two venues, right? You could have...
Now, the counteraction, though, Terry, is that situations like Albany would not occur. Like
unless
that,
Albany hosts...
That was magical.
Unless so for example, I propose that you have four pods, the top four seeds host the first round and quarterfinals. So you have, you know, a doubleheader. So
at Albany, so it wouldn't be one site; it'd be four sites.
Exactly. So like Albany hosts a game at noon and 2:30 on Friday, and then Syracuse hosts two other games at 5 and 7:30, and then the winners of those two games, you know, the first two games play at Albany at noon on Monday or on
Friday night, and then Sunday or
exactly.
Saturday, and then Monday. Yeah.
So that's what I'm in favor of, and I don't think it's ever going to happen, but I'm going to keep pounding that trumpet. All right, let's move on to some of the topical conversation. Goods on Sports wants to know, if the rumor that Michigan is really not offering much money is true, how does the job compare to Marquette and other new programs' head coaching positions?
No, I think it's a better job than Marquette, and we'll see. You know, we're starting to hear some candidates who have really come into play for this Michigan job, and I think we should know by the end of within 7 days. I'd be shocked if we don't know who the new Michigan coach is.
I think that's true if the coach who we've heard has been offered the job accepts it. If not,
you think they start over from scratch, or you think they have somebody ready?
I think what happens is the coach that they're speaking with now is one type of option from a salary perspective, from an experience perspective. What I have heard that is if they move on from him, the next two candidates are at a tier above. And that might sound counterintuitive, but it is what has happened in a number of these searches.
Yeah.
And so I think that it would take some time, both in terms of what we have seen happen over the course of the last year, which is offer, counteroffer from your home school, and then either exception or accepting a rejection. You know, last year, I think it's pretty widely known that Sean Adelin went through the process with Princeton and chose to stay at Towson and received a contract extension as a result. You know, I think that I think it's pretty well known that something like that, although maybe not to that extent, occurred with Joe Amplo and Princeton as well. So it'll be fascinating to see, but I do think, yes, I think it's going to be done quickly, primarily because I think that the candidate to whom it is offered right now is going to accept it.
Yeah, I think Michigan is a top dozen job in the country, and you know there some folks out there don't see it that way. I just see it that way. Yes, I think they got great academic. The pressure is not there, which is a positive, believe it or not. They have zero history, so you're building the history, and now with their facilities and their league. You know, the goal is to win a national championship because watch Ohio State. If you can compete in the Big Ten for the league title, you're relevant for the national title. And that's Michigan's goal.
To that point, one of the conversations has been, how long will it take for Michigan to compete for the Big Ten tournament spot?
2 or 3 years, max.
I would argue.
I think with a new staff in there, I think they could leapfrog two teams in that league quickly.
I would argue that they have as good of a shot next year as they do 10 years from now. And the reason is because the Big Ten is such that I think – so you got to win one game convincingly. You got to win one game close. And it could be against any opponent. Consider it this way. Which Big Ten program do you feel comfortable penciling into the 2018 Big Ten tournament?
Penn State
– team that did not make the Big Ten tournament last in 2015.
Penn State, I feel that I trust more than a Maryland team that lost a lot, more than a Johns Hopkins team that doesn't have a defensive midfielder goaltender, more than an Ohio State team that lost a great senior class. Rutgers would be second on my list behind Penn State.
Ohio State didn't make the Big Ten tournament in 2016 and made it to the national championship game in 2017.
I could see a similar profile to Penn State. I have no idea what their recruiting class looks like, and they do have to improve their defense and their role players. But I trust that team more so than the others I just named.
My argument is that
maybe Rutgers would be ahead of them, believe it or not, if they get if they get healthy.
And I think that that's only going to become even more true for every program, including Michigan. So my point is that you can't take this job expecting to be in the Big Ten tournament every year, or even 3 out of 4 years, maybe 2 out of 4 when you get things clicking. But even at Maryland, they're going to miss the Big Ten tournament at some point in the not too distant future. And it's not because Maryland does not have a team that could theoretically compete for a national championship. It's just because of the way that the season unfolds. And so I don't think that a fear of competing in the Big Ten should be a hindrance for a coach. And I'm not saying that it is for any individual candidate, but I've heard other coaches have told me, you know, one thing about that job is it's really difficult to compete
in
that league.
Yeah, exactly. What do you want, play in a scrubby league?
Right.
Is that what you aspire to do? Like, well, we play in an easy league. I wanted the Delaware job because I think we can kill 3 teams in the league every year. Like, you know, I don't get it.
And I think ultimately, you know, that's a part of the identity of the program, right?
To coach football in the SEC, to coach wrestling in the Big Ten, to coach hockey in one of these great hockey conferences, that's the whole deal. That's where you want to be. Where else would you rather be?
St. Bonaventure. So, Chris Yastrzemski, who's very active in the lacrosse Twitter sphere, wants to know what's up with the Bonnies. McDaniels Sports, who in his bio lists himself as a St. Bonaventure alum and as a contributor to, I believe, a couple local regional sports networks as well as ESPNU, tweeted that the hiring will turn heads and it could come as soon as Monday. That tweet, however, has since been deleted. At the time, so this was tweeted on Wednesday night, I didn't really have any read on who was in the mix for this job. Put out a few feelers, have a 5-name candidate list. I'm going to avoid naming the head coaches. may subsequently delete the part where I name the assistant coaches, but I think that the likely landing spot for St. Bonaventure conference-wise is the MAC. So if MAC familiarity has some value. And I think ultimately what we have heard about this coaching search, and Tim Kenny said as much on our podcast, is that we're not going to allocate our resources towards coach salary. We're going to allocate our resources towards providing the other tools that are necessary to be competitive in the league. And that harkens back to the point that we made about Michigan, which is, you know, the MAC is not the Big Ten. I don't think there are many that would dispute that. However, making sure that you have the resources to compete continuously in your league is a key factor in evaluating any job. And it sounds like St. Bonaventure knows that. So, you know, if McDaniels Sports is correct, we will know on Monday who that head coach is. And that'll be another one down. I got to say, you know, a couple things about this. You know, we've been reporting these types of news stories for years here at Inside Lacrosse, and they're really difficult. And we're about to touch on one that kind of straddles that line as well. And it's because the identity of Inside Lacrosse is much better defined as a media company as opposed to as like a journalistic outlet. And I say that because when we try to report these stories, we're doing so, you know, following our instincts and our understanding of the social science of journalism as well as possible. That being said, I don't necessarily think that we are as beholden to the tenets of you must report the absolute fact every single time. There have been situations where we've held certain stories in order to come to the finish line first, or come to the finish line most accurately. And I think last year, while reporting the Dom Stargia situation, was a really good example. You know, we were criticized in our reporting of the fact that he was not going to be offered a contract extension, because then he was offered a contract extension. I think he has since clarified that at the time, while he was not our source, that was true. He was told, you are not going to be offered a contract extension. Once we reported it, there's a very strong likelihood that the reason that he was offered some kind of contract extension was because of the response that the decision makers received in the wake of the report. Now, whether or not they would have received that anyway is impossible to say. Comes to pass that he did not like the terms of the extension, rejected it, and ultimately the initial report ended up proving true. Had he accepted it and remained the head coach of Virginia, aspects of the initial report would have proven false. Throughout that process and then the subsequent process for who Virginia ultimately ended up hiring, you know, there were reports that they were hiring Notre Dame coach Kevin Corgan. That didn't come to fruition. I say all this to say that, like, when we attack these, we try to be as judicious and diligent as possible. But Yeti Fjordstein has heard that Utah is really, really close to officially becoming an NCAA D1 program. What does that mean for the Pac-12, and what conference do they join? I bring it up in this context to say that there are aspects of this Utah story that both in terms of what Coach Brian Holman and his assistants have said publicly is well known. In terms of conversations that you and I have been privy to privately is not nearly as well known. And then also in terms of what else has been reported, it was reported by LAC Sports Network last July that Utah was going varsity as early as 2019. We chose to be pretty patient as it relates to the entirety of the story, and we'll wait to see how it comes to fruition. That being said, I have also heard that Utah is close to announcing Division I varsity status.
Yeah. Join the club.
I have heard that it is very significant for the Pac-12, and maybe someday I'll be able to tell you a little bit about how I've heard about how it's very significant to the Pac-12. And then as for what conference do they join, I don't think we know the answer to that. I think we can speculate as to who they're going to approach and who they're more likely than not going to be rejected by.
Yeah, let's discuss that real quick. You know, Big East with Denver and the Big East.
Yep.
Does it make sense?
You know. It gives the Big East insurance against losing Denver and as a result losing their AQ.
Okay, they could lose both to a conference that would consist of, let's say, Air Force, Denver, Utah, Cleveland State, Detroit Mercy, and maybe Bellarmine.
Yep.
a great Western Lacrosse League makes a comeback. And then there's obviously the Southern Conference as well.
So the Southern Conference, which is currently home to Bellarmine and Air Force, who you referenced. Yes, as you say, I don't see Denver leaving the Big East for that league from a competitive standpoint. That being said, there are a couple of other free agents who could be open, willing, and interested to be a part of that league. And I do think that that league that would be able to play for the first time in 2019 and maybe also, you know, then more likely and maybe smarter 2020, there very well might be another new program in between now and then that would be a better fit as well.
Could Utah, as a Division I varsity program, compete against and or scrimmage or play unofficially the MCLA teams in the Pac-12?
Yes, they could.
Would that count as a competition?
No. Similar to the way in which Cleveland State's games against Ohio-based D3 programs did not count towards many of their stats, basically their RPI, for example.
That would be beneficial for Pac-12 lacrosse.
No question. And I think that that's going to be an interesting development, not just, you know, now, but assuming there's some interim time between, this season right now when they played a MCLA schedule and when they end up playing a varsity schedule, if indeed that is what happens. Quint, it's lunchtime, which means that people are getting hungry. It's actually after lunchtime, which means we're starting to think about dinner. And that means that we need to start thinking about Blue Apron. It's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and it achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. You grow a lot of your own food.
Yeah, I have not bought lettuce at the store for the past 3 weeks, and I can't tell you, the cooler spring and now cooler as we get closer to summer now and with a lot of rain, I got some happy lettuce, bok choy, purple lettuce. I got
you got any cabbage going?
And all my herbs are doing great.
How you have any peppers going?
My issue is that there's a baby deer that I actually stumbled across twice during the morning last week in the backyard, sleeping in my sage patch, and this little deer stands up and runs. I almost had a heart attack, but and he picks, you know, he or she picks at a lot of my food.
Yeah, so for those of us that live in downtown Baltimore, like myself, you know, I've got like two pots. I've got a lot of peppers going, but really not a lot of fruit yet, which I'm disappointed by.
Patience, Terry, patience.
Got some cilantro.
Teaches about patience. Oh, cilantro's great.
Got some basil. Got some dill, which I'm still trying to figure out how to use.
My dill has grown through the roof.
My dill's going crazy.
Egg salad is good for dill. Salmon is good for dill. You can put it on chicken. It's good for dill.
Speaking of salmon, warm smoked trout and asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons is on the menu for an upcoming featured meal. Sliced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice. I don't know how to say that word.
You're making me hungry.
Elote-style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice. There you go. That's a use for that cilantro. What I'm getting at is that not everybody has the capacity to grow a garden in their background the way that you do, but that isn't going to prevent you from getting some really high-quality ingredients for a home-cooked meal. Not all ingredients are created equal, and Blue Apron makes sure that you get the freshest and highest quality. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 months, 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/lacrosse. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/lacrosse. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. We just got a couple of quick questions left that we are going to get to before we let you get on your way. Ryan Flanagan doesn't have a question. He just wants to know about MLL.
Well, I did a game last Friday at Annapolis, and the Bayhawks really struggled. The Ohio machine looked tremendous. I loved what I was seeing from Tommy Schreiber, best middie in the league right now. I think he had 7 points again, fresh off his indoor season. Jake Bernhardt has taken his game up a notch and is a viable candidate for Team USA. And then you got Peter Baum, and that's the best midfield in the league. I was blown away by their unselfishness. I thought it was one of the best ball movement offenses I've seen covering Major League Lacrosse in 17 years. Still some question marks. You know, I know their defense is rated high by the stat geeks. Again, you know, didn't get it done when they needed to at crunch time, and I'm not sure Just not sure that defense long term. We'll see. For the Bayhawks, you'll see a lot of personnel changes this weekend when they play the Rochester Rattlers. You're going to see a bunch of rookies in the lineup, including Josh Byrne of Hofstra, who the organization is very high on after watching him practice.
You mentioned Ohio. What did you think of Kyle Bernlohr, who was making his first or
great.
Second start?
And I was trying to figure out, you know, again, I go back to that championship game. He didn't play well. I know what it feels like because, you know, I had a similar experience. But, man, he was loose, and he was seeing everything. He caught so many Bayhawk shots and triggered transition, you know, to the point that Evan Washburn and I, we were like, you know, how many possession saves does he have here? Like, he not only is he making these stops, but he is clearly catching the ball and triggering odd man rushes. I was very impressed.
It's going to make for an interesting competition for Team USA because there is a divide between old and young right now in MLL in terms of who is, you know, kind of in the position to be the U.S. team goalie. And so, you know, whether it's John Galloway, who has extensive familiarity with John Donowski, having been a volunteer on his Duke staff, Drew Adams, who has extensive U.S. national team experience, Brian Phipps, who I think is a really quality backup goaltender, Jack Kelly, who last year was the best goalie in Major League Lacrosse after joining from the Brown Bears, or now Kyle Bernlohr, who I think at this point you would still characterize as a flash in the pan, but he was a two-time goalie of the year in college. So it's not to say that he doesn't necessarily have the resume behind him. You know, it'll be very, very fascinating to see. I'm not even sure if Kyle Bernlohr is on the trial list.
Interesting. Yeah, I've got to look at that. But the guys who stood out to me the other day were the midfielders I mentioned from Ohio. And
is Tom Schreiber the best player in the world right now? Is there any question about that?
What he did the other day was outstanding. And
reigning MLL MVP, NLL Rookie of the Year.
His prior game, he had 5 assists and should have had 8. When you watch the tape, he hits like 4 guys in the helmet with the ball. They weren't even ready for it.
It's crazy. I mean, it's really, you know, it's I've always had a very strong take on Tom Schreiber. To me, he's kind of, this word is going to sound weird, but he's kind of the perfect lacrosse player in the sense that his athleticism is so dialed in. Having gone to Princeton, having been the sole focus of an offense for 4 years, Long Island native, grew up son of a great player, running on the beach, focuses on the game.
High school football quarterback is the most important thing to me because those guys learn to operate with their eyes downfield. And you saw it in Ryan Boyle. You're going to see it in Jared Bernhardt. You know, the ability to dodge and not be so focused on the man you're dodging, rather to see through that man and look at your options downfield. It's equivalent to a quarterback reading coverages while the pass rush is right in his face.
Well, and it's interesting because he didn't necessarily attain the level of college success that his pro success would have suggested. And I think it was a function of his teams. I think that this talent was always there. And this level of production was always there. I mean, he was a 60-point midfielder that was putting up half goals, half, you know, 30 goals, 30 assists a season. It was crazy.
Yeah, didn't ever win a playoff game, I don't think.
I don't think so either. And that parlays in nicely to one of the last things I wanted to touch on, which is about the freshman rankings. Michael Sowers, very likely going to be number 1.
Yeah, can't argue with that.
Check out InsideLacrosse.com on Monday to see the final 25 ranked freshmen.
Really amazing the way that class started with guns blazing and kind of calmed down towards the end of the season and how some emerged late in the year and others kind of faded as we talked about them hitting that wall, and a couple of them did, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And some of them bust through it and I think are setting themselves up, like a guy like Trey LeClaire for an epic career.
And I think that part of that had to do with the steepening hill of competition. You know, certainly TD Erlin, that was what you saw, you know, in terms of Albany's facing off down the stretch. And so his numbers ended up being as staggering as they were at the beginning of the year, or even better, given that he got off to that tough start against Ben Williams.
And league play is the great litmus test, you know, because you get those 5 or 6 out-of-league games. Nobody knows who you are. But then by the time we get the league play, typically the scouting reports are out. It's, you know, Mac O'Keefe is a player I point to, had a tremendous start. But he was still good at the end, you know, but people started to realize what he could and can't do. And, you know, great year by him.
2 more questions about emerging lacrosse. Todd McRoby, should have talked about this when we talked about Utah. He's involved with the Arizona State Men's Sun Devil MCLA program, and he just wants to know about the MCLA in general. It's a whole other opportunities for players, a whole other opportunity for players to play while in college. Hashtag more than NCAA.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, and you know, honestly, if I were Division I head coach right now, I would be looking to get MCLA transfers because I think there are kids falling through the cracks who are ending up at some of those programs who are Division I caliber players. I guarantee we could go out right now and find 10 of them who you could add to a D1 roster and not blink. Great for the game to see, you know, the big name programs, the Auburns, the Florida States, the Arizona States. To see lacrosse on campus. When I cover college football, you know, I always go to the websites of the MCLA team where I'm going to get in touch with somebody to see what the practice schedule is going to be like, to see if it's going to be feasible, convenient, and where the party is after practice.
And then the last one comes from Syringe for You. ML Lacrosse All-Star Game in California again. Body by Jake living in California. When will we see more expansion into the area?
It didn't work in Los Angeles. It didn't work in San Francisco. And, you know, this is a weird area they're bringing the All-Star Game to this year. It's not a real lacrosse hotbed. I think potentially you could see the Rochester Rattlers moving to Frisco, to Dallas, would be a move. But if I were the league, I'd be back in Southern California, more in the San Diego area, because there's such strong lacrosse there now. You got to go where the people are. You got to go where the fans are. And our friend GW Mix has done a great job with that college showcase that he has at Orange County Community College, I believe.
Orange Coast, yeah.
Orange Coast, yeah. That's where you want to be. You don't want to be in other parts of California. You know, go where the people are. Go where the fans are.
All right, Quint.
I want to talk about the summer circuit.
Oh, yeah, you got one more. So yeah. I don't have the question to tee you up.
Well, you know, I was just – it was two thoughts. You know, finishing up my goalie camp this week and the amount of work the kids were putting in, and I think hearing parents talk about, now, oh, this is tournament season, where every weekend they're going to be going to events. I think we're a little misguided in the sport right now where – all our time is invested on the weekends to play four lacrosse games when we're not backing it up with work between Monday and Friday. You know, when I was wrestling in high school, you wrestle two matches a week. Okay, it's 12 minutes. Okay, you know how much you would train? Let's say 5 days of 2 hours, 10 hours for 12 minutes minimum, plus some. So think about it, 10 hours of training for 12 minutes. What does that equate to in lacrosse? What I would say for these young players, ages 6 through 16 or 18, 10-to-1 ratio. You've got to train for every one game you play. You got to train 10 times that amount of time to get adequately good enough to show up at one of these events. Because so many of you are going to these events and you're not good enough. You're it's a lot easier for a coach to cross off your name on the list than it is for him to circle it. Okay, so sometimes you're exposing yourself when you're not ready to be exposed because you haven't done the work. Again, a 10-to-1 ratio. The other thing, as I just took my daughter to the aquarium, and you're sitting there looking at these fish swimming a tank, okay, that's very much like the college coach sitting on the sideline. There's all these colorful fish swim right by. There's a big fish. There's a little fish. There's an orange fish. There's a blue fish. They're beautiful. They're amazing to look at. You can fall in love with any of them until the shark comes by. And the shark, let me tell you, when that shark comes by, it catches your attention, and you're like, whoa. You want to be the shark when you go to these events, okay? You don't want to be the little fish swimming around. Be the shark. Be the shark.
Be the shark. What a great motto. That'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. Thanks to Grace for hanging out with us. She really did some damage to that Harry Potter book.
Love it, baby. Summer of reading. Book a week. Here we go.
Be the shark.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.